to the popular show with me, James A. Smith. Delighted to have my co-host back with me, David Slavik. We've had a little break, summer holidays, and David, you've had a bit more of an extended break. The popular show is here. We're back. It's happening.
Absolutely. It's good to be here. And I just want to inform our listeners today that we are on three different time zones, and we made this work. Benjamin is in Utah. I'm not going to dox him. I'm not going to say this state just in case there are people trying to get him. But I think he's a nice enough guy that I don't think that's the case. And James, of course, is in the UK. And I'm on Newfoundland time, which is GMT plus 3.5. So we're all in peculiar times today. So welcome, Ben.
Benjamin Studebaker.
Great to be here.
You're the author of this new book, The Chronic Crisis of American Democracy, The Way is Shut. Our listeners will recognize your voice from your podcasting past. You used to be on the What's Left podcast years ago. I'm really happy about this book because it seems to me it's an example of the kind of like dynamic, radical political ideas that we were getting on the fringes of the left and then on what was called the post-left, coming into academia. This is a Palgrave Macmillan book. Anyone who reads academic research will recognize the typeface and the whole kind of layout. And I'm reading stuff that isn't just completely out of touch lib shit in that format. And that's exciting. Ideas that you could only get from podcasts and from online publications for years is now creeping into the institutions. So even though it's not an optimistic book and you wear that on your sleeve, I'm at least sort of optimistic and happy to see the kind of ideas that we promote on the show having a bit more of a kind of official form. Maybe you could just sort of tell us a bit about like how you see your project developing. You were in podcasting. This is based on a PhD, I gather. You're publishing in a more kind of academic form now. What's the plan? How has this developed? What's the story?
Yeah, so back in the old What's Left days, I was doing a PhD at Cambridge concurrently while I was doing that. So I had always a foot in both of those camps. I was in the pod space and I was doing the PhD. So the PhD is mainly about legitimacy crises in contexts that are different from 20th century contexts where people lose faith in the government, they have a revolution, they try to install some other kind of regime. The thought is that now when people lose faith in the government, they don't think that there is some other regime for them or something else for them to do. So then what do they do? It still matters that they've lost faith in the regime, even though they can't enact the revolution or adopt a different political system wholesale. So what other kinds of behaviors come out of that frustration? And that's what my thesis was very much about exploring. And this book is an attempt to popularize some of that while still keeping it academic enough that it can be published with an academic press. Going forward, I am kind of planning to play both sides of this throughout my career. I'm hoping to keep a foot in each space to do some stuff that crosses over a little bit in the way that this book crosses over, but also some more pure academic stuff and some more pure popular stuff. I think it's valuable to run the whole gamut and to be on both sides of that fence.
So, during the long 2016, when you and I both sort of started out as political commentators, David had been running for a little longer than us, there was a sense that the return of radical left projects, Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, the European variants of left populism, that this was a sort of antidote to the decades of post-political wilderness where that kind of crisis of legitimacy had really started to bed in. People didn't look to political parties as a way of solving their problems. Turnout was low in elections. Party membership was low across the West. Some of us, the kind of more hard-headed commentators, were willing to say that the rise of populism on the right was also to be interpreted as even if you didn't agree with a single thing that those guys were trying to do, at least this was a sort of contribution to a return of mass political mobilization and a return of the idea that, you know, these parties are different to each other and they represent different ideologies. So there was a way in which it was possible, even if you didn't necessarily like the direction of travel, it was possible to be optimistic during that long 2016, because at least it seemed like we were breaking with this kind of post-political wilderness and politics was back. Your book joins what is sort of emerging as a sort of current. We're seeing a few kind of examples of reinterpretations or kind of backtracking on that and saying, actually, that was a sort of false dawn. And what we haven't seen, we haven't seen a return of the political. We haven't seen a meaningful overcoming of that sort of death of legitimacy in those previous decades. Maybe you just sort of take us into something of that argument. Why were Bernie and Trump such a false dawn in your view?
Yeah, so I think the main thing that makes neoliberal capitalism distinctive versus other types of capitalism at other points in history is the level of capital mobility that we have now, the ease with which money moves around the world. And that mobility that money has is contrasted with a much less mobility on the part of people, labor, and of course, land and states, which are territorial. So we have the stuff that's less mobile competing for access to the stuff that's more mobile. And the people who control the stuff that's mobile can set the terms for where they're willing to put that stuff, since they always have the option of taking it somewhere else. So that creates an incentive environment where the stuff that's less mobile is constantly catering to the stuff that's more mobile. Money is the most mobile thing, and states and people are less mobile. So states and people are always accommodating money. I think that's the core dynamic of neoliberalism. The difficulty is, if you really want to disrupt that, then at some point you either have to govern the flows or you have to disrupt them. So I think the multilateral left-wing position of someone like a Yanis Varoufakis would be, let's get together and have a meeting and govern the flows in a new way. And the more unilateral Lexit or right-wing attitude is to cut the flows and just lock the states into their own boxes so that you can, within your own box, do what you need to do to structure your economy in such a way that things are more functional. The difficulty is in, if you're trying the multilateral approach, getting multiple states at the same time, elected governments that are interested in restructuring the system in a broadly similar way, all at once. And the difficulty with the unilateral approach is that the economic cost of withdrawing from the system is very high, especially in the near term. So even if in the long term you think you might be able to do something constructive through a unilateral strategy, the near-term cost tends to be prohibitive. It's hard to win an election if you've cut a bunch of supply chains and the prices of goods and services are going through the roof. So what we tend to find is that the multilateral stuff never actually happens. And the unilateral stuff, if it happens, it happens in a superficial way. So you'll have some kind of cultural withdrawal or superficial violation of the rules, superficial reintroduction of trade barriers, but it doesn't actually cut deep enough to meaningfully undermine the supply chains and kick up all that smoke, because politicians don't think they can survive that smoke. So in the book, I explore how these parties and movements make it look as if they're interested in either the multilateral or the unilateral strategy without actually delivering on that strategy.
Yeah.
And I think in the late 10s, we got excited because we thought there were people interested in these strategies. And then those people either couldn't win elections, couldn't get elected in the first instance, or if they did get elected, they didn't actually deliver on the strategy in any meaningful way. But they, of course, tried to pretend as if they did, put up a front as if they did.
I think that it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think that idea of sort of giving speech to the idea of both the unilateral and the multilateral approach, you could see in, like, even as early as 2006 in the Doha round of the WTO negotiations, which were supposed to be this great bringing force of adjustments that allow African countries and the countries that have been kind of been in the global south for a long time to develop. And then you would also see that in sort of climate negotiations, right? There was a lot of promises, you know, especially in the round that was in Brazil not too long ago. It's actually much longer ago than it seems. I think it was in 2012, 2013. And you saw these elites, you know, real elites, not Yanis Varoufakis, not, you know, like, I would say Yanis Varoufakis is an elite, but you understand what I'm saying. Like, you know, Hillary Clinton types saying, you know, we could do war to, you know, create climate justice and to create all these types of things. And you would see this like grand scale, and it seems, and I think, well, I'll defer to you on this, but it seems like that you see that in the consumer space as well, whereas, you know, as banks throw up pride flags, we stop talking about the 99%, right? So I just was interested to see if you've seen that mainstream, both on sort of like a center left, and even far left, but also as institutions have co-opted that.
Yeah. So in the States, I think the issue with the left is that the left has not been able to win a very large number of seats. It hasn't been able to win in very many places. And in Europe, you could make a similar kind of point that there haven't been enough left-wing governments elected in enough parts of Europe for Europe collectively to do anything left-wing. So in this kind of environment where you have some politicians who have managed to win elections, but not enough to do anything, the politicians have to pass off what it is that they're able to do as if it's significant. So in that environment, there will be a shift toward cultural stuff and forms of representation that are more discursive, that are about looking like, sounding like, acting like the people that you claim you represent. Since you can't act on their behalf or do anything for them, trying to pass yourself off as one of them, as similar to them, and adopting the various techniques of internet influencers to do that. I think that's what we've seen on the left. And part of what makes it especially insidious in the States is the tendency for the left to only really run in these very heavily gerrymandered democratic safe seats. The cost of elections and campaigning is so high in the States that left-wing movements calculate, okay, let's run in a place where you only have to contest the primary. And then once the primary is over, the general is a given. So you don't have to do two competitive races, which makes sense economically. You can understand why you'd prefer that approach. But the effect of this is that you only win in districts where a Democrat winning is a foregone conclusion. Yeah. So what it
you don't get any you don't do, get any territories on the risk board.
Yeah. And what it becomes rational to do is to take polarizing cultural positions that only please the hardcore Democratic base. Those then get taken up by national media, by Fox and so on. And that becomes a poison pill, which does kill any attempt to do anything outside of that kind of district.
So your squads, in other words, your sort of squads are, we're often sort of tempted to look at the behavior of AOC and fellow Congress people in very individualizing terms, psychologically or in terms of their own class background, etc. But actually, it goes beyond that. They're simply not incentivized to take up a meaningful universalist or left populist position because of who's actually voting for them at home.
Yeah, they come in the book. I do a little table where we run through this of what percentage of the voters in the districts of the various DSA and Justice Democrat endorsed Democrats, what percentage of them voted for Hillary Clinton? And it's an enormously high percentage in very nearly every district. Almost every district above 60%, most districts above 70% Hillary Clinton supporting. So it shouldn't surprise us that their perception of what kinds of positions are popular is going to be different from the perceptions of most people in the country.
How does that play out on the right? The Republican Party failed to do its job and contain its internal populist revolt in 2016. The Democratic Party did manage to perform that containment, and they've been sort of playing catch up on that ever since. We've just seen a televised debate without Donald Trump there, where every candidate seemed to be sort of playing a game of both returning the norm of the Republican Party to a sort of pre-Trump neoliberal, neocon worldview at the same time as sort of competing with each other to appear to be the heir to Trump. How would you describe that pattern or dynamic as it exists on the right? Why doesn't the right work either?
Yeah, so I think the thing that distinguished Trump from the other Republicans in 2016 was that he was committed to tariffs, trade restrictions, some kind of break on capital mobility. In the debates in 2016, everybody, including the people who had positioned themselves as far out Tea Party anti-establishment types, said, oh, you can't do tariffs because that will just get passed on to the consumer and lead to price increases. You've got to cut taxes and make the business incentive, make the business environment friendlier. You know, that includes Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, even Marco Rubio, who now kind of pretends that he's one of these NatCon types. Trump distinguished himself by saying, okay, I actually want to do trade barriers. He gets into office and he cuts up the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the free trade agreement that Obama was negotiating with the East Pacific states, excluding China. His strategy instead for dealing with China is to try to raise tariffs and trade barriers vis-a-vis China rather than give more concessions to other states like, say, Vietnam. The effect of this is to reduce imports from China by a very little bit and increase dramatically the imports from countries like Vietnam. So even though we didn't do the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the effect of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a huge growth in trade with other Pacific states like Vietnam or the Philippines, that took place.
Yeah.
And the trade barriers with China didn't meaningfully disrupt the flows. No. And once COVID hit, Trump became all concerned about getting reelected. And so he started dialing back on the tariffs to try to ensure that the economy would be performing well enough in 2020 for him to get reelected. So really, none of that stuff happened.
Yeah, and that number of the Vietnam imports actually is really deceiving. I was reading an article in The Economist the other day about the fact that essentially a lot of that sort of production from China has been onshored to Vietnam and then exported to us, or onshored to Mexico. And, you know, so for people who are not familiar with supply chains, it'll be 2/3 assembled, five, six assembled, 99 out of 100 resembled, and then they'll send it to Mexico, they'll put a flag on it, and they send it over. So, you know, that's even illusory, I think.
Yeah, yeah. There's even more that goes on in those states than the numbers seem to indicate. So he didn't really succeed in disrupting or changing any of that, ultimately. And, you know, now even the people who position themselves as anti-establishment alternatives to him, like Vivek Ramaswamy, is, you know, he's on the record saying to Elon Musk in the Twitter space, he wants to bring back the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So the attitude among the other Republicans is, if anything, you know, more free trade and more of this. So since he couldn't do anything about trade, he pivots and shifts to what he can do culturally, what he can do in terms of immigration, what he can do in terms of social issues. He attaches himself to every cultural debate that goes on in the country. And so the reason that his fans are fans of his is these cultural stances and not the economic stuff, because he didn't ultimately succeed in any of it. Going forward, Trump, I think, has a sense for his supporters that many of the other Republicans who are running don't really have. He seems to have a pretty good grip on what these people culturally want, whereas someone like DeSantis is doing a kind of intellectual imitation of what it is based on having watched it for a while. So I think a lot of those guys don't have as good a grip on it, and similar to the squad, have a version of the cultural politics that seems to them relevant when they go and hang out with each other in niche settings, but doesn't really work in the country and tends to not be popular across the country. So I think a lot of the same cultural problems haunt the right as haunt the left. But I do think Donald Trump is more in touch generally with his support base than the other people who are trying to get their share of it.
Obviously, Trump declined to appear in the debate and instead was interviewed by Tucker Carlson on Twitter, or what we're supposed to now call X. In that interview, I don't know how closely you watched it, but I felt like there was a slightly interesting dynamic where Tucker was sort of pulling it slightly more in the direction of the deep right of now and its preoccupations, the online rights that we and many of our listeners are very familiar with, while Trump perhaps is an example of that common touch that he retains and that you're describing. He doesn't quite sort of go all in on Jeffrey Epstein and the CIA and those other kind of those other sort of deep state preoccupations that now characterize the deeper online right. Nonetheless, Tucker Carlson a couple of times proposes that Trump is going to be assassinated. That if you know the impeachments fail, the attempt to imprison him fails, that he's going to end up being assassinated. In your view, I mean, maybe he will be, but I come away from your book feeling like there'd be no point in assassinating him because, never mind if he gets back on the phone with Steve Bannon, never mind if he goes back to the 2016 playbook, it can't work in your view. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that is fair to say. I think that there is insufficient support within the Republican Party for actually cutting or severing capital mobility in any substantive way. Trump immediately received opposition from the libertarians in the party when he tried to do it. So it was an uphill climb for him from the start. Now, many of the things he tried to do that were a little bit different for a Republican just went nowhere, like the infrastructure spending that he campaigned on and then could get absolutely no support for. The only stuff he could really move is stuff that Mitt Romney had pledged to do 4 years before, stuff like repeal and replace Obamacare or cut taxes for rich people. So there's not a whole lot he can do policy-wise. The thing that people use to try to get you worked up is to suggest that he can become a dictator, that he can do some kind of authoritarian project. The trouble is that for that to actually happen, you need other parts of the state to support the president in trying to stay on in defiance of his not possessing a Democratic mandate. And everything that we know tells us that the security services, the military, the officer corps, the civil servants and the government, none of these people like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. None of these people are into him. As soon as he got into office, everybody started leaking against him in the government. All of these guys started putting out every story they possibly could to hurt him. Loads of them are willing to testify against him in judicial proceedings. So even his own Supreme Court justices that he nominated voted, ruled against him in the Supreme Court decisions to do with the 2020 election. So he doesn't have any kind of base within the state itself from which to try to do some kind of executive aggrandizement. And something I sometimes like to talk about is, suppose that the January 6th attackers had actually managed to kill or hurt some number of people in the Capitol building. What would have happened? Do people think that that would have meant that Donald Trump would have stayed president? Do people think that that would have meant that democracy would have ended in the United States? It's not at all obvious that that's the case. Generally, what happens when we have conflict in the United States, even very serious conflict like the American Civil War, is that we make a point to keep doing the elections anyway to show how committed we are to the fundamental system. Everybody rallies around the Constitution, and then you just keep going with it. I think if there had been some kind of act of violence at the Capitol building, that would have resulted in people rallying to the Constitution and to the fundamental system, and people insisting that all the procedures be followed very carefully in replacing anybody who was killed or hurt. The whole point of the American system, the whole argument for it, is that it's bigger than the particular people occupying the offices. It doesn't require them to continue. And we would have made a whole point of demonstrating that. That's why we've got that big, long, deep list of who becomes president if people die. Yeah. So that if it ever happens that large numbers of
people what number are you again, David?
Killed.
158 or something?
Yeah, I think I'm vestigially still the town solicitor for Berwick, Pennsylvania, because that I got elected and then they got rid of through legislative act that job. I got elected and then they called me up and they said, we have bad news for you.
That was the real steal.
So at this point, I think because Pennsylvania is one of the first states, I would say that, probably about 400.
You've demonstrated why the way is shut for the left and why it is shut for the radical right. Maybe we'll come back to some hopeful counter arguments. What I like about the interviews you've been doing Ben, is that even the most cynical platforms and podcasts and interviewers are put in the position of, oh, come on, it's not that bad. it becomes our job to try to sort of present the hope trademark.
I think it's kind of interesting because I remember some sort of hardcore lefties. I hate to bring up the dumb drama, but getting after you for being too optimistic or too believing the system too much. And then, you know, I'm reading 5 years later. Here I am reading this beautiful book that's very well laid out piece by piece, and it's not cynical, it's realistic. It's just, you know, their cynicism and realism are very different. And how do you feel about talking to people who are super jaded about being more jaded than them?
Well, I can understand why people think I was optimistic. I mean, I was doing pods talking about, you know, the Sanders campaign and getting invested in electoral politics. And the reason I was doing that, yeah, before 2015, 2016, I had a pretty negative attitude about American democracy and its potential. You know, it was because Bernie Sanders outperformed my expectations in 2015 and 16. He broke, you know, I made a little rule in my head. I said, I'm not going to pay any attention to the Sanders campaign unless he gets over 10% in the Democratic primary polling. And I didn't think he would get to 10%. And when he got to 10%, I went, okay, so I have assumptions about the system that are more negative than is
the facts justified. Changed.
They're clearly not in alignment with what I'm thinking. So I need to give this a chance, because if I can be wrong about that, I could be wrong about a lot more of it. So I gave it a chance, and I tried pretty hard. It was also the case that at this time I was meeting with my supervisor at Cambridge, David Runciman, and he was telling me about, you know, really, you think, you know, there's any chance anybody would get interested in a different political system apart from the one we have? Really, look around. And I looked around, and there is an enormous amount of support for the American political system in the abstract. People don't like the politicians. They don't like specific institutions. They wish the procedures worked a little differently. But when you start to drill down into the, okay, you know, do you want a different political system? Do you want something that doesn't work like this? Even if you just ask people, do you want to change the way seats are allocated in the Senate? All of a sudden, you get almost no support for something like that. Very, very quickly for, you know, second chamber reform, stuff that is routine in many other countries. No support for this really whatsoever, apart from maybe about a hard, you know, 25 to 30% of the population.
Yeah, and it's even simple stuff like term limits, or, you know, this term limits are like such a interesting, and we won't get into them because there's all sorts of positive and negatives about term limits, but, you know, that's one of those like real just off the shelf reforms that a lot of places do, even at the local level. They're like, you know what, two terms, that's it. You can't be a lifelong politician. And people love that shit, but there's no interest in it actually. You know, we see this with McConnell and Dianne Feinstein. I see that, you know, the Democratic Party saying, yeah, it's great that we have zombies. It's awesome, you know. And then you have
you can't run on that. It doesn't generate any energy or enthusiasm. And the thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of people who get involved in Democratic politics for any period of time, it's not because they believe in the system or they're optimistic. It's because they don't think that revolution or more radical change is possible. And conversely, people get involved in revolution and radical movements because they don't think that anything can come out of the democratic system. There's a kind of miserable running between the two ends, but really neither one of the ends is getting anywhere. And if you really want to get negative, then you have to get past thinking that either one of these things is coming anytime soon.
Yeah,
I was going to get us onto why the way is shut for centrism as well. You know, we're used to talking about the radical left and the radical right on this show, but you give equal hearing to why the way is shut for the currently triumphant centre as well. But maybe we can handle revolution before that, because you treat that as well.
So I just want to have 100% confession here. I'm a former employee of Third Way. So this comes up in your book, so especially in the Nina Turner context. So I would like to let you know that, and do not adjust your comments accordingly.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, on the question of revolution, I think people have a hard time actually going through what are the steps and what actually is involved in doing something like that. So first thing to point out is that in most contexts where a revolution occurs, it's after a war has happened, and there's been some kind of mass conscription of people, right? And because there's been a mass conscription of people, there are a bunch of people in the army who are not hardcore, I want to be in the army people. They're very much like the regular population. So when there's some kind of strike, the people in the army sympathize with the people who are striking. And when they're told to shoot the strikers, they won't do it. And it's in that moment where people with the guns are told to shoot the people who are protesting or striking and refuse to do it, that they become mutineers. And because they are now mutineers, they have to take out the people who have ordered them to shoot the demonstrators, because if they don't, they've committed treason or mutiny, they're going to prison. So it's only in that situation that a revolution really comes off. There's got to be a large number of people who are refusing to go to work. Then there's got to be soldiers who are told to do something about it and refuse to. People can't even imagine how we would get to a stage where there's a large number of people who refuse to go to work, much less a situation where there would be lots of people refusing to go to work and the professional army of the United States would refuse to clean them up when ordered to clean them up. And there have been instances in American history when the army has been ordered to clean up demonstrators, and it's done it. You know, the most nasty incident, I think, would be probably the March of the Bonus Army in the early 30s during the Depression. 1932, the Bonus Army came to camp in the National Mall to demand their bonus payments from the Hoover administration, and Douglas MacArthur became convinced that these people were communists and they were plotting some kind of revolution. So he called out the army to bulldoze their camp with tanks. And these were veterans. These were people who had served in World War I who were protesting. And yet the active duty soldiers were willing to bulldoze their camp with tanks. So even in the 30s, in a situation where people were very depressed and there was a considerably larger amount of enthusiasm for an alternative regime, communism, than there is now, it was still the case that the soldiers were not just willing to stop demonstrators, they were willing to stop veterans. They were willing to bulldoze and run over veterans in their tanks. So if you can't do that in 1932 during the Depression with Hoover, how are you supposed to do that now? And I think that, you know, now we have a number of other things that make it harder, like the government is much better at giving people little bits of money in a crisis, you know, those checks that were sent during COVID, little tiny sums of money to make them feel seen. Yeah. And these people, you know, they're not people who would have gone and done a general strike or would have put their lives on the line for revolutionary action. So when they get a check without having to have put themselves in any kind of danger, they're just grateful to get anything because they wouldn't have done anything in response if they'd not gotten the check.
I think I agree with that totally. And I think that that's probably what held Canada together. They had a pretty interesting and liberal system here as far as going giving out sort of checks and relief in different ways. But what they did, and this is the typical neoliberal way, and I think this is what actually radicalized people, is that the requirements were very simple and you check the boxes. And then after the fact, they would come back and say, well, I don't think you really deserve this. And then they made that process really complicated. As people were getting back to work, they have kids and things like that. They don't have time to fill out all the paperwork afterwards. And I think those sort of things, because of the propensities of neoliberal regimes, and I think Canada is like probably the weirdest combination of social democracy and neoliberalism probably ever, that you see these sort of like people who wouldn't be radicalized because they were comfortable suddenly become radicalized like after the fact. So I think that I think you're right, but I think there are other sort of compounding factors like inflation, interest rates, the resumption of student payments, right? Those types of things that I think are, I see your thesis and I agree with it 100%. But then I also see that the world's getting so much harder every day, you know, when eggs are $6, like that money doesn't count as much anymore.
By the way, if the prerequisite for revolution is that the army won't shoot the protesters, this is part of the justification for the popular show's pro-troops position, which is to say that we need these depressed former leftists to be enlisting.
Yeah.
the best thing that the sad Bernie bro can do is join the military and start rising those ranks so that when the time comes, we've got some representation there. when you see me in khakis, like Elvis when he was conscripted, getting my lovely blonde locks shaved off, then you'll know. Yeah.
Well, I think it's quite possible that a lot of disaffected Bernie bros will have the chance in the next year.
Yeah, the most effective thing Nixon ever did to hurt the left was to abolish conscription in the United States.
Yeah,
this is it. The left-wing case for conscription.
I'm 100%. I'm national service conscription. I'm for it.
Get the deadbeats in the military. Yeah, for sure. Why is the way shut for Biden then? Why doesn't centrism work either?
Yeah, so I think just as we have to be realistic about the obstacles to any kind of reformist or revolutionary movement, we should not underestimate the degree to which everybody's miserable. And this is, where David's point is really very sound. Things are getting more miserable. They are getting more miserable at a pace that people can feel that's noticeable. Things are really miserable. And really, this book is a synthesis of, on the one hand, stating and elaborating the degree to which things are really miserable, and stating and elaborating the degree to which that doesn't mean that the system necessarily will collapse or change. And I think there's the kind of 20th century attitude about legitimacy is if people get miserable enough, then things will have to collapse or change. And what I'm trying to get people to think about is, what if we have a system where things being miserable doesn't necessarily lead to collapse or change? What do people then do? And so the argument I make is that on the one side, you have college-educated professionals who are not able to get the jobs or have the careers that they hoped they would have when they made the decision to go to college. I call these fallen professionals, right?
Yeah.
The fallen professionals have a standard of living that is broadly similar to people who don't go to college. All they really have from college is the experience and the cultural capital and the sense that they know words that other people don't know, that they're conversant in discourses that other people are excluded from. So that part of the population, I think, gets really caught up in esoteric debates about political terms. What does liberty mean? What does equality mean? It gets caught up in cultural wars, cultural signaling. It gets caught up in types of representation that are superficial, that don't really touch the economy. And insofar as this part of the population tends to dominate left-wing organizations, it gradually, I call it, McGovernizes them. It turns them into organizations that only speak to professional cultural concerns and which marginalize and exclude ordinary working-class people. Now, at the same time, I think that those ordinary working-class people are increasingly frustrated and put off by politics in a general sense. If we look at the Trump base is more petty bourgeoisie, it's more small business than it is traditional working class. The traditional working class is increasingly skeptical of all of this stuff. To some degree, it's given to conspiracy theories about specific groups of people or specific cabals of individuals that are framed as having taken over the whole system or running the whole thing. But I think this is really just a consequence of the labor unions being either co-opted or disintegrating. They're not really being any media organizations that are by or for working people. So there really is no availability of any good substantive narrative that someone who is a traditional worker can or should trust. In this environment, to stay engaged in politics is to be increasingly atomized and alienated from all of the political discourses that require you having gone to college. So when the workers do try to participate in politics, they use the wrong words in ways that make them easy to marginalize and easy to point to as, see, this is what will happen if you don't keep doing centrism. These stupid, ignorant people will take over, and they'll just do stupid, ignorant things. And as this happens, it becomes more and more obvious to the workers that there's really no point for them to even try, because anything they say in politics can and will be used against them. So I think the long-term trend for the workers is to try to get out of politics and hide from it, and to look for those spaces in civil society that are ostensibly meant to exist, according to the liberals, that are separate and distinct from the public realm and from politics. You're supposed to be able to have your private values in these spaces. And so later in the book, we go into these enclaves that I call the four Fs: faith, family, fandoms, and futurism, the places that you go when you're trying to get out of politics. the difficulty is, as more and more people go into these spaces and try not to be involved, and voter turnout fluctuates more cycle to cycle, if you're a political strategist in this environment where there's a lot of culture war, you are not going to get a lot of votes by trying to get the swing voter that people used to try to get in the 20th century. You will instead get votes by activating these people who have tried to get out of politics and fled to the enclaves. Mm-hmm. So what you'll do is you will go into the enclaves and you will try to stir people up, get them back involved in politics, get them to reengage, present the other side as threatening their enclave in some meaningful sense. And you can do this from many directions. At this point in the United States, the rates of political action are higher for non-evangelical churches. The evangelical churches are at this point a little bit exhausted from political activity, and they're not as active as they used to be. The churches that report higher rates of direct political action are more progressive-leaning churches, often Black Protestant churches. So that can go in both directions in the faith space. It's not as if that's a purely conservative space. Yeah. Similarly, when I say family, I don't just mean, say, traditional family or nuclear family. I also mean other kinds of households. You can present the other side as threatening or menacing particular kinds of households. And this will be very easy to do because, in point of fact, all households are being menaced by the economy. It is becoming harder to run any kind of household, to buy any kind of property, to pay your rent, to pay your utility bill. So it will always be easy to position the other side as threatening or menacing your particular household model. When it comes to fandoms, when it comes to futurism, people are getting attached to particular companies, particular oligarchs who promise them good entertainment or who promise them a future to believe in, but a future that comes out of a spaceship that looks like a phallus. These things become other places to libidinally invest. I think for a while, those tech oligarchs were trying to avoid getting drawn into politics. But after 2016, it became increasingly difficult for them to do that insofar as they own social media companies and those social media companies necessarily make political interventions.
Can I give you an anecdote that's going to prove your point 100%?
Yeah,
2015, I had a nonprofit that I had started. It was basically like a 501c4, and it had to deal with like innovation and choice in sort of new technological realms. And we had done some work for Solar City in Florida, which is basically we were getting people to sign on to a referendum to allow rooftop solar at a consumer level that was installer based. It's very complicated, but then we worked for Tesla. And I have to say that was one of the most interesting and disconcerting things I've ever done in my life. But we had these really nice people who were really interested in Teslas, like just really interested. And we were fighting this real bad guy, which was the Car Dealership Association of Virginia. And all we wanted to do is have a second Tesla dealership. Now, the Tesla approach was, we'll just build it. And that's like, it's Virginia. It's not going to work. It's like that Virginia actually works as a state in ways that most states don't. And they have regulations and things like that. It's pretty effective. So we had to go through this sort of like quasi-governmental body to get these lobbying. But we had to rein in all these Tesla owners to come and give testimonies. And half the testimonies were just like, this is just really great. And I'm really enjoying this experience. I think other people should have this opportunity. None of these other dealerships want to sell the cars. So, how are we going to get this car? Right. The other half were like, Elon Musk is our God. We love him so much, he's doing everything. And it was quite funny because it was mostly single men, right? So it was actually like the jihad of the IT worker. And, it was like, I found myself in sort of an Osama bin Laden tech version trying to lead them, to some sort of direction. And I think you're correct.
Yeah, I think it also goes on a lot with entertainment. The whole fight about Star Wars and original Star Wars, old-fashioned Star Wars versus new Disney Star Wars is another instance of politicizing what is for most people traditionally an escape from politics and from these kinds of controversies. These entertainment products used to be an attempt to unify people outside of politics.
Yeah. Taylor Swift.
That's not what they do anymore. Example.
Lizzo, right.
They're
Taylor
all
Swift.
Politicized to try to get those people who are fans of those people back into politics, back engaging. It's a constant, desperate attempt to leverage the libidinal energy that is being siphoned away from politics by people who, you know, quite rightly recognize that none of these movements care about them or are going to do anything about them.
I think this is a very clarifying way of understanding why 2016 was such a false dawn. If it seemed like it was a repoliticizing, if it seemed like it was a an escape from post-politics, actually, it was, as you described, this kind of faux politicizing of all of these kind of ways of not doing politics. And as I mentioned before, so other people are sort of creeping round to theorizing this. Anton Yeager has referred to hyperpolitics as the kind of the follow-up to post-politics, not a return of the political, but this kind of this histrionic political layer that seems to have kind of covered over everything, even as business as usual, decline as usual, just continues. The New Left Review has had by now a year-long debate over the concept that its contributors have proposed of political capitalism, where it's not so much that you hope that your team or the party you're supporting is going to actually pursue your interests. The political involvement and the political battle is getting your team to win and stopping the other team from winning. So, it doesn't matter that it was Trump who locked down America. It doesn't matter that, as you described, Trump didn't bring back jobs. It was enough that Trump had to win, and it's enough to make Trump win again, regardless of what the actual outcomes were. And it's pretty clear that that applies to American liberals as much, at least, as it does to the right, where there is, in fact, almost no interest in what Biden's agenda was or was to be. It was all based on stopping this guy who, in this shifting kind of range of ways, was all just the kind of the epitome of the unacceptable. So I think that what you bring to the table here is a really useful way of understanding that we've kind of lost. Everyone is political. You know, the dads on the school run are political in my suburban town. Everybody thinks through this kind of frame of politics. That is what 2016 has bequeathed us. Nobody actually believes that there can be any kind of material outcome from these political battles that seem to be occurring on absolutely every layer of the culture.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a section of my book where I frame these rump professionals, the professionals who are still able to get into the prestige jobs, as balloonists, who start their careers initially trying to help people on the ground by, you know, going up into a balloon given to them by the institutions and using the balloon as a vantage point from which to see, you know, what are the problems and where should you go and what should you do? And initially, when they're not flying too high, they can see a lot and they can hear people on the ground and they can shout back to them. But, you know, as they get higher, they have to get out a bullhorn to be heard, and then that tends to drown out the people who are underneath them. And the higher and higher up they go, in an effort to see more and more and attract more and more following and be seen from further and further away, the less they can see or hear, and the more they're focused on the other balloons in the sky and competing with those other balloons in the sky. And gradually they get to a point where all they're interested are the balloons. Nothing they say can be heard by anybody, and they can't hear anything from down below. But by that point, there's some other young person on the ground who is excited to accept a balloon, and the whole thing goes on. Yeah. If this goes on for long enough, what happens? Well, what happens is that everybody on the ground decides that everyone with a balloon is a bastard, and that the balloonists are all being controlled by some kind of demon cult that you should want nothing to do with. And when somebody's in a balloon telling you what to do, you should tell them to fuck off.
That's funny. I just had a discussion with a very right-wing person about this, like, just without the terminology, because at this point I hadn't gotten the copy of your book, and that it was this woman, Peachy Keenan. She has this book about American radicalism. She's definitely a right-wing, like very far right, but she's very pleasant, and we have a nice interchange. We have honest discussions, and we talked about that little boy who had the Gadsden flag on his back, And I just said to her, I said, this is red state Greta Thunberg. And she's like, I agree. This is awful. Like, you should do this to your kids. And I realized that we're in this situation where we're just like constantly sort of like re-injuring the next generation so that we could start them on the balloon trip sooner. So they're more exploitable. You know, I mean, like, you know, Ben Shapiro was like a national debate champion who got mad about, I don't know, abortion or something, you know, like this starts earlier and earlier. And then there isn't even an aspirational balloonist. You can't even be a 20-year-old union organizer and get into Democratic politics. You had to have somebody ban your science project. It looked like a bomb. You know, I mean, it's just, yeah. It doesn't work that way.
The worse things get on the ground, the more everybody wants a balloon. And that means that the conditions imposed for receiving a balloon can be more ideologically stringent. And the range of things you can do with a balloon contracts. They don't have to offer you as much in exchange for the balloon if you are desperate for it. And that's what's going on now.
Child soldiers just want a warm meal and someone to care about them, you know?
Yeah, what people really want increasingly is just a job in the institutions, regardless of whether you can use it to do anything at all.
Yeah.
let's touch on the question of fatalism and pessimism. And I'm going to sort of take the angel's advocate kind of position for a second. Look, I'm not going to ask you to badmouth your mentor and benefactor and supervisor. But as you mentioned, David Runciman, I remember him in 2017, after the 2017 general election in the UK, where Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party won 40% of the vote, something that was regarded as even more impossible than Trump winning the election the year before. And I remember Runciman saying, well, I have to admit that maybe I don't understand politics at all, which would have been a kind of a charming gesture to make if he didn't continue to be a top politics professor at Cambridge and the principal political contributor to the London Review of Books, et cetera, to this day. It's worth remembering kind of little moments like that when the real authorities, and Runciman's a clever guy, obviously, where the authorities just had to kind of stop and cease and have their mouths open. I guess if your book is about the impossibility of anyone getting their political projects off the ground, the thing about the impossible is that it happens every now and then. And 40% for Jeremy Corbyn was impossible, and yet it happened. The outline you were giving of I forget the language that you adopt in the book, but the distinction between if you're going to cut loose from globalization, you either do it in one country or you get a whole bunch of countries to do it at the same time. So remind me and the listeners of the terms you used for that.
Yeah, the multilateral approach and the unilateral approach.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the critique of the unilateral approach, we got that all the time in the Corbyn project, kind of socialism in one country, you're going to have Lexit, and then that's going to create all these problems for people. Okay, so be it. I never accepted it insofar as it was used as an argument for not trying Corbynism at all and not supporting Corbyn at all. But yeah, I take the point. As for the multilateral issue, of course it's very difficult to get a whole bunch of governments to all want to follow the same agenda simultaneously. But again, the impossible happened. What you had was a moment where it seemed like there was this huge polarization, right-wing governments coming along, very successful left-wing parties appearing. But what was just under the kind of surface in that, briefly, was an emerging consensus of a critique of globalization. Globalization, which, you know, only at the start of this century, Tony Blair was saying that you might as well question autumn following summer. That's about as useful as questioning globalization. So we've gone from globalization being nature to the right and the left all being opposed to it. Now, are they opposed to it in different ways and for different reasons? Sure. But just as in 2016 there was a path for Bernie, 2017 there was a path for Corbyn, all of these projects obviously have a very short shelf life, and we should remember that when whatever interesting thing comes along next. You have to work very quickly these days. But while that shelf life was still live, there was something there. There was some kind of space for negotiation or consensus. So I just wonder if there's a good bit in the book where you get down in writing something that, you know, I think I feel like I heard you say years ago on air that the left has a kind of kettle logic of we were cheated out of winning, we couldn't have won because of structural forces, and if we had won, they'd have stopped us, etc. But I just wonder if there's a version of that logic in your own argument whereby it couldn't have happened anyway, it shouldn't have happened, etc. I guess I'm putting it to you that it did nearly happen and could have happened, and I'll never stop believing that it could have happened.
Well, I think that the difficult thing is, historically, usually, even if you have a very strategic, well-organized movement, you need help from some kind of exogenous shock event to actually get where you're going. The left is usually willing to acknowledge that crisis is something that has to play a role in change. There has to be some kind of crisis of capitalism. The tendency is to not want to take that point fully seriously and to try to rationalize small crises that are survivable as the crisis that will deliver that kind of change. Mm-hmm. And nobody would argue in public for creating a crisis of that kind deliberately or engineering a crisis of that kind, much less creating or organizing the kind of crisis that actually could make these things possible, because these crises involve very serious costs. And you couldn't run for office going, I'm going to start a crisis so that we can reorganize the economy. Right. So I think that's where it gets difficult. And what we've seen in the last 20 years is that there have been a number of different shock moments, 9/11, 2008, COVID. And when these things happen, there is a set of people who go, this is the crisis, we can finally do something. And what we find out is that these crises are not severe enough to stress the system enough. This is in part because the crises are smaller than they would really need to be in any case, but also because the ability of states to cope with crises has increased over time as the capacity of states has increased to deploy different kinds of emergency measures to get through and get around these things. I think we should be just amazed that inflation wasn't much, much, much higher, given that China was shutting down factories and not producing, and that the United States reopened much earlier than China did, and that mismatch should have produced really severe shortages of all kinds of things, we would imagine. But if you had asked us, okay, let's say there's a pandemic and the United States and China don't agree and don't coordinate their responses, and China shuts down for a long time, the United States doesn't, shouldn't there be crazy inflation? If you imagine what would the world look like, you would think it would be unimaginably terrible, and that everything would be in a shambles. And that's what people in 2020 were saying was going to happen. It didn't happen. So the state had much more capacity to manage the crisis than I think most people recognized. And then also that the crises that have worked in the past are things like multiple world wars, right? Multiple world wars. And then as soon as the world wars end, they come together and do GATT, and they do the WTO, and they start reopening the trade, reopening the flows. Those wars, which in many countries gave an unprecedented amount of power to the working class, only produced temporary and fleeting concessions. And at the point at which the labor unions in the West were at their peak as a consequence of all the leverage they obtained from those wars, the working class was still out-muscled by rich people in the 70s and 80s, even after all of those advantages that had been gained through those incredibly terrible conflicts. And now, people talk about, are we in the Gilded Age? Are we in 1848? They act like we're back where we started. Well, even if we were strategically as intelligent and clever and savvy as people in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and we're not, even if we were, we would then need help from these exogenous events. And so at one point in the book, I talk about, let's say you were committed to engineering such an exogenous event. What is the event that you would engineer? Well, it would have to be something much greater in scale than the current war in Ukraine or COVID or 2008. It would have to be a bigger kind of shock that would be more than the system would be able to deal with. And the example I give in the book is a major great power war between the United States and China, which no one is going to advocate for. And if you did advocate for it, you couldn't win an election.
I would have said that 2 weeks ago, but I have seen in the news, normal people say, you know what? Maybe we need to do it. And this is on both parties. And I am absolutely shocked. I thought that everybody just liked their cheap stuff and that Amazon was great and that we were just going to keep it flowing. And I don't see how the United States could win that war. That's my personal opinion. And two, I don't know what they see coming down the pike that they think that that's necessary. So I'm going to let you continue, but your statement, I would agree with 2 weeks ago, said absolutely. But right now I'm like, maybe they could win a war election at this point. I don't know.
I think a government could start a war with China if it wanted to. It couldn't run on doing that, but it could do it.
Yeah.
It would have to make it look like it was forced into it. And the way it would do that is by astroturfing some kind of movement
false
for
flag.
Recognizing Taiwan's independence.
Astroturfing,
and this has been a little bit played around with, the idea of Taiwan voting to, you know, try to become a state of the United States. There's a movement in Taiwan, a fringe movement.
I think the UK just recognized Taiwan as a state. Is that the case, James? That they had said that they have all the behaviors of a, it acts like a duck, it quacks like a duck.
We're testing the waters here just as much.
So it's possible to engineer it by saying, Taiwan has a right of self-determination and China's not recognizing it, and to try to talk your way into this. And the Europeans would object to it just as they objected to what we were doing in Ukraine. And we could ignore those objections and force the Europeans to go along by doing nasty things to them, like blowing up their pipelines. There are things we could do to engineer such a crisis. The thing is, I think the only governments that would be interested in doing that are governments of the right at this stage. They're Republican governments. And if they did it, they would not be doing it for the purposes of accomplishing left-wing goals. Now, the argument you could make in response is, well, the Tsar started World War I not intending to accomplish left-wing goals, and nonetheless, left-wing goals were accomplished. Of course, that requires not only that conflict, but that conflict to go the way it went, the Russian army to get beat up enough that the army would mutiny in that kind of way. And then also it requires there to be people like Vladimir Lenin or the Bolshevik Party or very, very organized left-wing elements with a strategy which is appropriate to the time and the context. And even with all of that, the Soviet project ran its course in 80 years. It wasn't able to convert that movement into a kind of politics which could ultimately survive. So I'm going to ask you
a devil's advocate question. What do you think about your statement on China is you can't actually run on that, right? You could talk tough, whatever, but you can run on bombing the cartels of Mexico, which I actually think might be just as bad of a situation if it created, just as a resident of NAFTA, as I'm no longer a resident of the United States, I could say that I would find that very troubling. I like my avocados. I think that we, it's very important that we have that border.
If the ports are open, I don't think it's enough. And it's not enough even to close, say, some American ports. You have to close the ports in East Asia.
With
enough conflict in the Pacific that those ports can't run and ships can't go through the South China Sea. That they're totally unable to make it through there safely.
Yeah.
That would force all the supply chains in the world to reorient. Not just our chains in the Western Hemisphere, but all the chains.
Yeah.
And that's really the level of disruption that you would probably need to be able to very quickly make a whole lot of big changes and be able to justify that.
Yeah, just the balance of trade, I think, makes it kind of impossible, too, because you just think, like, if 40% of American pork is going to China, they've been telling us that we shouldn't eat bacon for years. We can't just suddenly be like, hey guys, it's patriotic to eat bacon again. we can't sell the Sapporo that's being made back here back to China, what are we gonna do?
It may well be that the right eventually kicks off some kind of conflict like that. And that may be the way in which all of this stuff is ultimately disrupted. The trouble, looking at it from an American point of view, is that our left is in no position to make use of a crisis like that, even if one were to occur.
Nor do you want them to. This is the uneasy thing to admit. I don't. You know, even if they could, even if they have been secretly seeding the army, and even if the crisis comes along, I don't want the current left-wing version of faith, family, fandom, and futurism to be in charge of anything.
No.
I think, you know, maybe with the sort of Zoomers, we've got a kind of opportunity for re-education. But the kind of the sheer, like, you know, hysterical naivety of the currently sort of ascendant post-Bernie left, I'm sorry to say, I don't want it in charge of anything at all.
Yeah, I think the boomers and I'm on the edge of a millennial. I'm like half a millennial. I find that there is some sort of institutional credulity going on. Mm-hmm. That I'm surprised by, actually. You know, because I'm like, these people, you know, they grew up, weed was getting legalized, maybe because things were kind of getting a little better on some sort of these incremental things that you talk about, like some of the presentational things. So I think they see more of themselves in the government. I mean, boomers because they are the government, and millennials because, you know, they're sort of governmental proxies, are all sort of look like them, have the same haircuts, whatever, et cetera. But I wonder, you know, is it fixable given that I just, after COVID, and I think some of the counter, and, you know, people have a lot of different opinions on this, and we've been kind of out there on it. I think the relative, like, I'm going to do what I'm told thing is just so much stronger than I thought it was in any generation. I was quite surprised. And, like, I'm not saying you shouldn't protect yourself or be careful, or, like, COVID's bad. I've had it. It's awful. You know, I still don't have a voice. I had it 2 months ago. But I'm pretty surprised how people were like, yeah, man, like, we should have security checks at every restaurant. Like, I was like, wow.
Well, I mean, that should bring us on to another contemporary issue, the return of the mask mandates in American colleges. So it's very really the kind of passing of the ways just increases. It's unimaginable in Britain, and I'd say in Europe right now, but it continues to be the form of, well, elite distinction making, a kind of negative privilege. You know, elites today perform their superiority by what they forbid themselves from having, and the impediments they place on themselves. That what is it? So we had Loyola, and now Dillard University has mm-hmm. has returned to mask mandates,
which I actually. And so, Ben, I just wanted, because I know you know the geography of this, but we have a lot of listeners in the UK. So these are both, I used to be an adjunct for Loyola University's law school several years ago. And it's a Jesuit school that has a sort of strong left leanings. I would say it's left college, but in New Orleans, these college enclaves are in neighborhoods. They tend to have sort of, I wouldn't say they like integrate to the community that well. I'm just going to say that there's some sort of like elite versus, you know, subaltern stuff going on. And my theory is that seeing two schools in New Orleans, it's because it's an us and them thing. And the distinction, it's almost like I always say the Southern liberal is the most like the most militant, right? Because they live in Athens, Georgia. They live in, you know, places in North Carolina with lots of breweries. You know what I mean? And then they're trying to say, like, I'm not like those people. So I wonder if that's what you think is going on here, or it's just I don't know.
Well, that's definitely a factor. Red state liberals overperforming liberalism in response to majority cultures. That goes on in all the red states. I see it a lot in Utah while I've been here. My home state of Indiana, there's plenty of that. Mm. Not, I don't think that's just a Southern thing. That's just a red state in general thing. On top of that, I think that the event that COVID is most similar to, I think initially COVID was received as is this like 2008 is in an economic shock event. But I think as we get more distance from it, it's clearer that the event that it's most similar to is 9/11. And the primary function of 9/11 was to increase the willingness of people to embrace various security, health, and safety measures. And the Zoomer generation is the generation that doesn't remember 9/11, has never gone to an airport and gone directly to the gate and said goodbye to their family from the gate, has no idea what that world was. You know, the 20th century was a much less safe world. And that was part of what people liked about it. When boomers tell stories about what it was like to ride their bike around in the 50s and 60s, there's always a story of, remember that one time I almost got hit by a train, or remember that one time we almost drowned in the pond. That world is gone. And the Zoomer, and the reason that I don't
Safety
think we
world
have a
is
ton
bad.
Of hope about the Zoomer yeah. is that the Zoomer was born into a world where there was no danger. The idea that the state is supposed to protect you from danger is baked in from very early point. And at this point, Zoomers have spent a substantial percentage of their time in what I call the loony years, right? Their time on the planet includes the 3-4 years after 9/11 and the 3-4 years after COVID. Those are periods of time when just about everybody went nuts. So if you've been in a culture where everybody's going crazy about safety for almost 10 years of your life and you're 20, you know, your chances of having some kind of, you know, resistance point of view on things like mask policy is pretty low. Now, when I talk to students, I used to teach Gandhi at Cambridge. And so I used to ask students when we would teach Gandhi, you know, is there a law or a rule, you know, let's say that you had to break every law that you disagreed with. You know, what would be, you know, the law that you would do satyagraha in the face of? And what I found amazing is that students could not come up with one. They could not come up with a law that they would break on principle. They couldn't.
Not even jaywalking.
No, people couldn't come up with much. One of the more creative answers.
What about marijuana?
Somebody said, and this is what I think tells you a lot. One of my students said to me that what he would do is he would allow his friend who didn't get into Cambridge to come with him and sneak him into all the classes so he could get a Cambridge education.
So he's going to Goodwill Hunting. That's his Goodwill Hunting his way to the revolution.
Microsoft Teams Goodwill Hunting. Oh, my God.
What sorry. I think tells you.
No, I'm sure he's a lovely kid. I understand what you're saying. Go ahead.
What I think is really profound about that is that the number one fear of the Zoomer is that those rump jobs, the rump jobs that as the millennial generation went through uni, got harder and harder to get. And over the course of the time millennials were going to uni, you had to do more and more and more to make yourself competitive for those jobs. At this point, there is just total fear of doing something that will cause you to be unable to get those jobs. Committing any kind of offense, stepping out of line in any way can put you, or seems to be able to put you on a list of people who can't get these jobs. And so for a lot of young people, there is an absolute fear of breaking the rules. Because if you break the rules once, then you'll never be allowed into the prestige professions and you'll be just thrown in with everybody else.
I mean, being mainly exposed to students who are in a less prestigious university, and unless they were already primed for it through family, don't think that they're going to get into prestige professions at all. I see more consciousness of the direct relationship between what they went through in lockdown and the absolute devastation of their lives and the devastation of the mental health of everybody that they know and the physical health as well. So I think that there may be a class component in that. And I think that as well, what you're describing is obviously and visibly true, and we're going to see it in the incoming managerial class. All those pathologies are things that are going to be telling us what to do for years to come. Elsewhere in that generational cohort, I think that there is a nascent openness to our politics and our leanings, you know, leftism, populism, whatever it is. I just say that as another, nugget of hope.
No, I'm going to second that. I'm going to say it in two ways. Used to work for this externship program in Washington, D.C., where we would bring students from about 50 or 60 universities, some from Canada, some from the UK, et cetera, in D.C. And then I would teach them public policy and advocacy. And then later on, I took over the law program. But I would see students. So in this capacity, I would see students from Emory, you know, sort of on the higher end of things. Then I would see students from like working class schools from Indiana or whatever, right? Like sort of state schools. And it was very interesting because I saw that inverse, there was almost an inverse curve as I went on. As the jobs became more scarce, the kids at the liberal arts schools got more scared. Because they came in, they're like, well, I've been free thinking for the whole last 4 years, and now I'm at an internship. And then I saw the state school kids, and they always did really well because they knew how, they said, I got to check these boxes. You know, their parents were working class or you know, like teachers or police officers or something like that, right? You know, some sort of profession, but like not an elite profession. So you would see them, and they were so good at their internships. They would check. Then I saw the change where when the jobs became tighter and the outcomes, people getting hired out of these internships became tighter. I saw the elite kids become masters of language and masters of outlanguaging the kids who were actually better at their internships. So we would get students who were like reporting on each other for being, what at the time, I didn't even think about the term woke at the time, but they were just like, you know, I think that was a little insensitive and things like that. So I saw some of that sort of, those elite Jedi mind tricks become more necessary and also become more infuriating for some of these working class kids who are just really well-intentioned, good-hearted people and doing great. And they were just getting, they're like, why am I in trouble at work? I didn't do anything. I just took the last coffee. I thought it was all for us, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think another aspect here is that the number of people who are going into the humanities and social sciences is just decreasing. Both in raw numbers and as an overall percentage. So also all of the students that we would see are less and less representative of the ordinary student who goes, well, I can't get a job doing that. I'm going to go be an engineer. And it's interesting to hang out with my brother, who's an aeroastro engineer, who says that the living standard for engineers now is not as good as it was for new engineers. Engineers who come in now, you know, can't immediately start saving up for a down payment on a house. Their incomes are no longer enough for them to immediately buy a house within a few years of getting a job out here. That for engineers,
which sounds great. Yeah, yeah.
I think this is coming for the STEM fields as everybody piles into the STEM fields. Just as once upon a time, everybody piled into law. That's going to have a gutting effect on the leverage of people with those degrees. And over time, that's going to cause those people to go, wait a minute, maybe the advantages of doing an engineering degree aren't natural, but are the product of contingent factors that have now changed on me.
You know, it's interesting to see Peter Turchin and elite overproduction kind of come back into the forefront. Because I remember like hearing a lot about this, you know, sort of, it wasn't the exact term, but when they talked about sort of former Yugoslavia, and they talked about, they had done a really good job of educating sort of young professionals that could be leaders. And then they had too many leaders in a decaying sort of situation. Do you think that, and this is tough because, you know, we've all been involved in academia in one way or another, and I think James is, you know, very much involved, how do we, and this is, I don't know if you have this answer, but how do we like make that elite overproduction not a liability?
Ooh, how do we make it not a liability?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, is there a way, and I'm saying learn to code. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if we want these goals.
I saw you say a smart thing on Twitter about this, Ben. What did you say? That for as long as universities only exist to give a, albeit small, wage benefit to the people who go there, the people who don't go there have absolutely no reason and have every reason to oppose them. So the answer for universities is they have to be doing something for the people who aren't going there.
Yeah.
I think that's very right.
Yeah. The question is, how can we get the people who go to university to then go and do something for the people who don't go there, given this tendency to hang on to the cultural marker as a way of resisting proletarianization and distancing oneself? You'd think, okay, if you're going to proletarianize a lot of educated people, then wouldn't those educated people end up in the ordinary workplaces alongside the people who didn't go to college? And wouldn't they then organize those workplaces? Well, maybe they would if they could accept that this is really what had happened to them. But there is a lengthy period of denial about this fact, and an unwillingness to accept this fact, and a constant attempt to differentiate oneself. I'm an individual. I'm different. I'm special. I went to college. I'm a free thinker. Blah-de-blah-de-blah. They're sheeple. This thing that people who have are autodidacts or who have a little bit of education do when they're stuck in that proletarian environment that makes them very ineffective as leaders. So there's got to be some overcoming of that. And how is that to be done? I think to a large degree, the system is designed in such a way to manufacture that sentiment. And that sentiment is constantly kicked up and gasoline is dumped on it through the culture war.
The Chronic Crisis of American Democracy, The Way is Shut by Benjamin Studebaker, I think is a really important and welcome contribution to these debates that are going on and that we've been a part of too. And it's great to have these arguments in writing and in this form. And it's really wonderful to speak to you as well, Ben.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Absolute pleasure. I just I've been excited to talk to you, and I think that I could have talked to your offer another 2 hours, but I'm glad that we kept it tight. And everyone, thank you very much. And Ben, I'm going to do something that I think that you don't necessarily like to do. What can we plug for you here? What is your Twitter? Where can we find you? And if people wanted to buy this book, where could they find it?
Yeah, so my Twitter is at BM Studebaker, because my middle initial is M, Benjamin Michael Studebaker, that's my name. My website is benjaminstudebaker.com. On my About section, you can find everything that I write. I usually put out a blog post when I have something new that comes out anywhere, whether it's on my blog or off my blog. So if you subscribe by email to my blog, you'll hear about anything new that I do. The book, the cheapest way to get it is on Springer's website. Springer owns Palgrave Macmillan, and on their website, you can always buy the paperback for a relatively reasonable price as these academic books go. So that would be my recommendation to those looking to get it.
It's a good one to have on the shelf. While we're doing the advertisements, we'd love it if listeners would consider supporting the popular show. If you want an independent radical media, you do have to get your wallet out. Occasionally, you can get us on patreon.com/thepopularpod, where most recently we put out the full uncut video versions of our Christmas COVID critical tapes. People often accuse me of fighting yesterday's war over COVID, but the recent episode on the ongoing economic devastation of lockdowns in Africa with Toby Green shows that this is by no means a historical issue, and the return of mask mandates in American colleges show that it is still very much ongoing. Well, it's great to be back. Thanks so much for listening.